Welcome to Season 5, Episode 7 of Beyond the Zero. I'm your host, Ben. Joining me today is Tanya DiRosario. Tanya is a writer and visual artist, and her new book, Dinner on Monster Island, is out now from HarperCollins. Welcome to the show, Tanya.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me. You're joining me today from Vancouver, British Columbia. Tell us about life over there and moving, I guess, from Singapore to Canada.
Yeah, so I grew up in Singapore. I spent 37 years there before moving to Canada. I'm currently living and working on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. And I've been here for about 5.5 years now. I got here, I took the school route, so I applied for an MFA in creative writing at the University of British Columbia, and for a while after that I was an adjunct in the department, and now I'm back to doing freelance work.
Okay, amazing. I want to ask you about how you got involved in this world of art and literature, because you're a visual artist as well as a writer, but Tell us about getting involved in that kind of world.
So my first stint involving writing was my first year out of secondary school. I'm not sure what it's called in Australia. Maybe that's essentially high school.
Yeah.
Oh, secondary school. Cool. Mm-hmm. And I got a part-time job ghostwriting ghost stories for a small publishing house, and that helped me finance my first year of art school before I started doing other work. And while I was in art school, I realized that I was doing a lot of writing in my sketchbooks, and I think that's where I first consciously started working with words, mainly poems and like phrases, and just like thinking in terms of language. So yeah, I think my art and my writing work kind of started in tandem.
Okay. In terms of the visual art stuff, what's your medium? What do you kind of use for visual art?
For many years I worked in oil painting primarily, but just kind of the practicality of space and living in an apartment, and currently living in an apartment in a pretty expensive city, has kind of just caused me to work smaller. So I do a lot of drawing now, small drawing, and I got into comics a bit back. So primarily that's been the work I've been making in the past few years. When I was in school, my final year, I did a lot of installation in text, and that is also, I think, where my love of writing came about and my kind of conscious working with words. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I want to talk about your new collection, Dinner on Monster Island. It's a series of essays about your experience growing up queer in Singapore. You begin with an essay about being basically exercised by your grandmother at the age of 12, and you move on to being enrolled in a school weight loss program at the age of 11 called TAF, which backwards is fat, obviously. You also cover your love for horror films and the tightly controlled conservative nature of Singapore's culture and politics. But can you tell us how this essay collection came together, and what was the process like looking back on your youth writing these essays?
Right. So the book started with an essay that I did not realize at the time would be part of a collection. When I first got to Canada and started participating in the program, the very first assignment I got was from one of my nonfiction professors, and it involved writing a letter to someone. And my mother had died the same year, and we had a lot of unresolved issues between us when she died. I had left my bio family's home a decade and a half prior without telling anyone who lived there that I wasn't coming back. Mm-hmm. And I'd only seen her once since then, and that was at a funeral. So for context, I'd lived with my mother and her parents. So It was really strange kind of experience. Like you leave one day and then 15 years later, you come back and everyone who was in that house is now gone.
Mm-hmm.
And that experience was what the letter ended up being about. So I ended up writing a letter to my mother, and that is where the collection started. And as I took more and more classes, I started to realize that a lot of the work I was putting out dealt with experiences growing up in Singapore, living there as a young adult. And I think that is when the seed of the collection was planted. So I think, in short, like a handful of essays were written for class, after which I drafted a fuller proposal for the book and then wrote the rest of the essays towards that proposal.
Okay. And that letter to your mother, that's the final essay in this collection, the way that you put together.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's kind of book ending, like an incident that happened with my mother right at the beginning when I was 12, and then ending with a letter to her after she died.
Well, I want to start with that first essay, and
sure.
And that essay is basically where you account this incident when you were about 12. You were quite a boyish 12-year-old at the time, and your mother had kind of cut ties with the church, but your grandmother was very, I guess, religious. But can you tell us about that experience? And you mentioned the impact this had on you, and I guess the growing love for horror films and things like that, because you kind of lived through one in a way. But can you tell us a bit about that story and that impact that it had on you?
Okay, so when I was 12, I came home from school one day, and I found my mother waiting for me at the bus stop, which was already unusual. And doubling up on that strangeness was the fact that it was clear she had been crying. So I knew immediately something was up with my day. And what had happened was two of my mother's friends from church had come to our house to speak to my grandmother. So my grandmother had spent her life being a very devout Catholic, and my mother was evangelical, and that was always a cause of tension in our house. And when I asked my mother at the bus stop what was wrong, she told me that my grandmother had converted.
Mm-hmm.
And this happened in the course of a day. It was like nothing had happened the day before. So it was a very, I had a very weird feeling about it. I didn't have language for it at the time. But when I went up back to our apartment, her friends' attention was refocused on me. So my mother basically told me to, you know, go take a shower, come back out. And I came back out, and they started talking about asking me why I was, quote unquote, dressed like a boy.
Mm-hmm.
Like a boy. For listeners, I'm making air quotes because gender clothing is bullshit. So, so they proceeded to then, you know, talk about me being a lesbian. And this is like a word I had not used on myself. And how they were going to cast the lesbian demons out of my body. Spoiler, did not work. This was a very long process that involved primarily shouting at me, which they clarified was not actually shouting at me. Shouting at the demons inside of me. And at the end of, like, around, one thing I remember clearly is that it was around the end of the 7-hour mark that I was just kind of exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that to basically get them out of my house, I would just have to relent and say, yeah, and to show them it was over, and which was basically to concede, to agree,
mm-hmm.
right? To stop being angry and to agree with them. And I think what was interesting for me about that experience was that I had already I had an understanding, I think, already of the fact that I was not straight.
Mm.
But I hadn't had language for it until they gave it to me. So in some sense, like, this was a terrible thing that happened, but it is also a kind of a coming out story.
Wow.
So yeah, I think the biggest impact that had on my life, you know, apart from being like kind of a traumatic incident, was that it also pushed me out of the closet for myself.
Wow.
Yeah.
You also talk about your, I guess, the nature of your love for horror films, which you get into a bit later in the book, but in this sense, you know, looking at films like The Exorcist and later The Ring and things like that. But can you tell us about, I guess, that leading you into some of these more horrifying aspects of film?
The first film I think that got me into horror was Hideo Nakata's Ring. I just fell in love with the protagonist, Sadako Yamamura. For anyone who has not seen Ring, in a gist, it's about a young woman named Sadako. After being thrown in a well and left to die, the spirit of her rage is imprinted onto a cursed videotape. So once you watch the video, you will receive a phone call, and in 7 days she will find you and kill you. She looks at you, you know, with that evil eye, and your heart stops. And what you learn at the end of the film is that there is no way to truly conquer her, right? So the only thing you can do to survive is to make a copy of the tape and pass it on to someone else so that the curse transfers to them. So in order not to die by the monster's hand, you must in some sense become the monster. And this was a concept that was really interesting to me and got me into horror, got me into Asian horror. And the more of it I watched, I realized that many female ghosts in Asian countries were constructed the same way. So they were kind of treading a really thin line between agency and oppression. So on one hand, she's like an autonomous character who seeks justice on her own terms. On the other, she's reduced to a victim of violence while she's alive. And this agency is only granted like in death. So like in the transformation of her identity from victim to villain. So the potential of this duality, like the idea that revenge is also justice and the monster is also the victim, really took hold of my imagination. And I kind of started writing personal stories through the lens of like certain female protagonists slash monsters in horror. And I found that that was a really interesting duality as well, that the protagonist is also seen as, you know, the source of monstrosity, or seen as the monster. And yeah, it was kind of a natural. The first essay opens, you know, including the film, including some sections about the film The Exorcist. And it was kind of a natural thing, because why would I not write about that? This is something, it focuses on a topic that it was like directly related to me. And yeah, I think like you said, I think a lot of my love of horror just starts from the fact that I lived it.
Yeah. Very interesting. Within that, and you wrote about this previously as well, about this idea of these female monsters in horror films, and that difference between some of the male-written female protagonists and then some of the more, I guess, female-written female protagonists, especially in Asian horror films. But do you want to just tell us about that difference between some of those male-written characters and some of the female ones?
Oh, I think I think that was less about horror films and more about mythology. So there's a lot of myths about certain creatures that in history, one of the ghosts that lives in Malaysia, Indonesia, and Singapore is the Pontianak. And traditionally, she is seen to target pregnant women or virgin girls, but mm-hmm. so, again, air quotes with virgin, because that's nonsense. But there are a lot of women filmmakers, writers, academics who are now reframing the Pontiana as almost, I don't think the word feminist is used, but that's the way I often read it as being framed. And these days, she's less likely to attack a woman and more likely to be a cautionary tale for men who attack women, or men, just men in general. Like in Singapore, we grew up a lot with the idea of the Pontiana who hails a cab in the middle of the night, and the driver is someone who's like generally like, because she appears to be very beautiful, so he's immediately attracted to her, and then he ends up getting disemboweled. So I think it's really interesting how the story changes over time and with context.
That's really interesting. I want to move on to the second essay in the collection, just because I think it leads on nicely. But in this essay, you're about 11. In your school, they start this program called TAF, which we said was fat backwards. And essentially, it's a weight loss program within schools. And I guess this program is, it kind of targets, you know, people who are, you know, within this category of being overweight or obese or anything like that. And they really did kind of roll out this program in a massive way in Singapore. And I think in this essay, you also say that it's only just recently, I think, stopped being in play. But do you want to tell us about that and that experience within your schooling?
Yeah, I don't think it was recent. I think it was quite a number of years ago that it was stopped. But yes, for listeners, the TAF Club, as we call it, TAF actually stands for Trim and Fit. But yeah, backwards spells fat, which was just and continues to be hilarious to me. It was a program that was rolled out in all public schools. By public schools, I guess I mean schools that fell under the purview of the Ministry of Education. And this was primary schools and secondary schools. And it was meant to reduce the obesity rate in kids and teenagers. Although I will just say for the record, like based on my memory, I recall a lot of the girls who I was in it with are not people I would think of as obese, although even the word obese is kind of a moving target that means nothing context to context. But yeah, so my understanding based on experiences from people in other schools, the conclusion that I came to was that this program was implemented nationwide, but from school to school, there weren't very many guidelines that made it cohesive. So teachers would basically just do what they thought would make kids lose weight. So people took very different approaches to the program. Some, like in our school, a lot of the time we were girls enrolled in the program. I won't even say enrolled because it was compulsory. People who were put into the program sometimes were just barred from eating during recess. We had to exercise instead. I've read about a school where kids were segregated in the canteen, so all the so-called fat kids were at one table and they were given a particular amount of food to eat, whereas everybody else could just, you know, get their food normally. I've read about experiences where the kids had to come in the morning before school and go up and down the stairs. And a lot of the time in my school, if people didn't attend or had an attitude about it, there would often be ways to like shame those girls into coming. Yeah.
In terms of that kind of thing, for your, I guess, how do I even refer to it? Your sense of pride in your own body, like how did that affect you?
That's a really interesting question. I'm not sure whether it was the exorcism or just something in my personality, but I feel like I was really defiant as a teenager growing up. And a lot of the time when rules or ideas or about who I was supposed to be were placed upon me, and if they were things that I didn't agree with, my reflex was to be angry about it. So I never felt ashamed about my body. I never felt ashamed about being queer. I was angry that these things were being done. Mm-hmm. And I think people talk a lot about anger and how it's bad for you and how it's bad for your body. But anger really helped me through a lot of things growing up. Because I think the only other reaction I could have had was to, like you said, listen and then be ashamed, or listen and then go into hiding, or listen and develop a whole bunch of self-esteem issues, honestly. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it made me angry. It made me want things to change.
Mm. So I want to ask you about Singapore, the monster island in the title of the book. So the penultimate essay of the book is called Dinner on Monster Island. Within that essay, you kind of reflect on moving away from Singapore and some of the things that have changed in Singaporean society and viewing it, I guess, from an outsider's perspective now. You also mentioned the fact that having moved away, you're not really sure if, you know, you fit in Canada or you fit in Singapore anymore. I think you're a bit like me. You've kind of moved cities a number of times and you feel like you don't really feel at home anywhere. But can you, I guess, reflect on looking at Singapore from that lens of being someone who can look at it from the Canadian perspective now?
Right. I don't know if I can look at it from a Canadian perspective. I mean, because I'm not Canadian. Yeah. But I can definitely look at it from a perspective of being far away for an extended amount of time. There's some things that have changed for the better. When I left, Singapore was still retaining Section 377A, which criminalizes sex between people considered men under the law. Mm-hmm. That 377A is a British holdover. It's a colonial law, and it was repealed in January this year, actually. Mm. So that was a lovely thing. Another something else that was taken away was immunity for marital rape, which was still there when I left. So things are slowly changing for the better. It's very, very, very slowly changing. Just want to emphasize, because, you know, activists have been working against the tide, even with regards to these two specific issues, for years and years. And I think one of the first things that struck me coming here was how much I had normalized, how much my body had normalized in terms of, you know, in terms of Singaporean culture and in terms of Singapore in general. So I didn't intend to write about Singapore when I got here. I just wanted to leave. And going back to the Tough Club, I wrote a line about it in an essay for one of my classes, and I talked about the incident in which we were made to exercise during recess in view of the canteen, so in view of the other girls who were eating. And it was just kind of a throwaway line in an essay. And then one of my classmates was like, hold up, can we talk about this a little bit more? This seems like a really petty action. And I think that was the first time that I spoke about something that was just something that happened, and had somebody who doesn't live there say, oh, this is an interesting point. This is, I want to know more about this. And I realized that there was a lot that, people were interested in. And it kind of made me realize that a lot of the stuff that was happening was, I think I normalized it to a point of, to just for the purpose of coping. Mm. So that's something I discovered about myself, given a bit of distance. So I think I've just come to, and you mentioned also about belonging in Canada versus Singapore. And I think I've just come to a conclusion that the idea of belonging in terms of country is just not in the cards for me. Mm. As a queer person, I don't think I'm ever going to feel like Singapore is my home. As somebody who, has just come here, I don't think it's possible for me to just, put the first 37 years of my life behind me and kind of be able to feel completely like I belong here either. And I think that's fine. Mm. Some people just don't get that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there a place you want to go back to at any stage?
Not to live. I have friends and found family and community there. And I was part of the creative scene for so long. And obviously those things are important. Those are things I feel homesick about sometimes, but not enough to make me want to live there again.
I want to ask you just one of the tourist questions that I feel like is relevant, because a lot of people I speak to who have been to Singapore or who have lived there complain about food everywhere else. So is that one thing you miss about Singapore?
What do you mean, complain about food?
Because everywhere else they say the food is not as good as the food in Singapore.
I would say, I guess it depends on where you are. The food in Malaysia is good. So there are two things in the everyday about Singapore that I really miss. One of them is definitely the food, but it's not just the food being good, is the food being relatively affordable compared to a lot of other places. You can get a good meal for a good price there, and I think that's definitely something I miss. The other thing I miss is Singlish. Just because I think a lot of us were taught in school that there's a proper way to speak, and then there is Singlish. And a lot of us, for a lot of us, that translated into, if you're in a formal setting or a work setting, you speak so-called proper English. But that also means that, what is the opposite? What is the opposite of being in a being formal or being professional? I learned really quickly here that Singlish for me means intimacy. And it's a way of speaking. It's a language of intimacy when somebody reciprocates, right? Because being casual with someone as a way of being intimate with someone. And I found that that is something I really miss, because even if people understand me, people can't respond. So yeah, that is definitely something I miss about Singapore, along with good, relatively affordable food.
All right. I want to ask you, what are you working on after this collection? Have you moved on to something else?
I'm working on my anger issues. I'm working on, I hesitate to say I'm working on a collection of poetry. I'm more just like accumulating poems as mm-hmm. they come. I'm also working on a fun collaborative project. I can't really talk about the details, but I'm excited to be collaborating with illustrator Marion Churchland on a project that involves words and images. I'm also just trying in general to get away from nonfiction for a while, because this has been a lot. So what I'm actively doing is I'm trying to, you know, collect more things that interest me or that concern me or that anger me. And I'm trying to find out what it means to fictionalize those things.
Yeah. It does strike me that this collection is, it's obviously a personal collection, but, you know, I think, you know, we've touched on when we weren't recording the fact that there's, I guess, I feel like there's a lot of sensitivity that you have about the subjects you cover in this book and the personal nature of the book. So I just want to congratulate you on writing something that is this personal. And I completely understand that you would want to move on to something that's less personal and you know, and put some things in fiction and explore things in other,
absolutely,
in other ways. Yeah. All right. I want to ask you about your gateway books. What were some of the books that opened the world of literature for you?
Yeah, so like we spoke about earlier, I write mostly poetry and essays, but a lot of my gateway books were fiction. And I would say that the most major one was the one I read at 14, which was Stephen King's It. I was obsessed with it. At one point, I read it back to back 3 times in a row. And wow. I think most people know it's a really thick book. I loved the characters. I loved the prose. I loved the compassion with which King writes about underdogs. And it was one of the books that when it ended, I felt like I had lost friends, you know, which is what kept me wanting to reread and reread it. And I think a lot of that was also subconsciously thinking about what he was doing with language and what he was doing with pacing. And yeah, I think that was probably the major gateway book for me that made me think about how something is done. You know what I mean? With in terms of a book.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah.
Cool. All right. I want to ask you about what books are you currently reading or have you recently enjoyed or you're looking forward to in this new 2024? Gosh, 2024. That's crazy.
Oh, that is a wild 2024.
Yeah.
I feel so old. I reread books a lot as I just illustrated with it, but and I've been doing a lot of rereading recently, and one of the books that I love that I've been rereading are Marion Churchland's The Chom book. Marion is the illustrator I'm working with, and Chom is spelled HCHOM, and Churchland describes the word as the sound of something delicious being bitten into. And it's a beautiful collection of illustration and writing that examines the act of like wanting and desiring things and objects as a joyful but also monstrous but inherently human quality. And the reader that guides, the creature that guides readers through the pages is a delightfully like grabby goblin who has a habit of hoarding things. It's absolutely delightful book and it's wonderfully written and beautifully drawn. I take a lot of comfort from it. I think another book I'm rereading is a collection of poetry called Short Film Starring My Beloved Red Bronco by Kay Ivor, who is a wonderful poet. And this book just speaks so resonantly about love and pain and grief. So those are two books that I come back to and have been rereading recently. So one book I'm definitely excited about is a book called Big Mall by a young writer and journalist, Kate Black, that kind of centers, it's nonfiction, a bit of nonfiction, based on the writing I've read of Black so far. It's like a mix of memoir and journalism, and I believe the title refers to the departure point of the book, which is Edmonton Mall, and I think she writes so beautifully about space and how it connects to history and how it connects to people. And that's coming out this month, I believe. And that's something I'm excited to receive in my mail.
We'll take a quick break here. On Beyond the Zero, we're speaking with Tania De Rosario. This episode is brought to you by Curtin University Northern Territory's Advanced Acronym Course. Enrollments for Semester 1, 2024 open now. Use promo code for 10% off your course fees. Enroll today.
That's offensive!
We're back on Beyond Zero. It's time for Tania's Desert Island Books.
Books I would take onto a desert island. Written on the Body by Jeanette Winterson. I would put that probably as also my second gateway book that I read as a teenager. Crush by Richard Sykin. It's just a collection of poetry, like A Seed with Its Singular Purpose by Cyril Wong. Wong is a Singaporean writer. One of my writing mentors, and he was, I believe, Singapore's first queer confessional poet. And this is such a beautiful collection. I would also take on, I realize now that I'm seeing it, that this is a lot of poetry. I would also take on Gillian Christmas's The Gospel of Breaking. Christmas is a Canadian writer, who's just an amazing poet. And I was going to name like a book by Stephen King here, like just almost a pick one, but except when I really thought about it, it was like, it's a desert island. I'm assuming this question is because I'm alone and I don't necessarily want to be reading horror on that desert island. So that we'll leave that last one blank as I continue to think about it.
Yes, I don't know if I'd take Stephen King either to a desert island. It would be could be horrifying, but yeah, anyway. All right, I should wrap it up with you. I want to congratulate you on this collection, Dinner on Monster Island. It's just fantastic. It's intimate and it's wonderfully written. I really enjoyed reading it, so congratulations. Before I let you go, do you want to tell us where we can go and grab the book and also where we can catch up with you online?
The book is available directly from HarperCollins. And of course, you'll find it in multiple places online. And I always encourage readers to go get books from their local bookstores, their favorite local bookstores, especially. You can find me on Instagram. I think that's my most public social media. My website is www.taniaderosario.com. I'm also on Twitter, but you'll have to add me because it's a private account. And I'm sometimes on Facebook.
Excellent. Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining me. It's been such a pleasure chatting with you, and congratulations again on the book.
Thank you so much. I've loved being here.
Thanks to Tania Di Rosario for appearing on the show. Check out the show notes for all the details. You can find us on X and Instagram at Beyond Zero Pod, and you can email us at beyondzeropod@gmail.com. Don't forget to support this podcast by heading over to patreon.com and searching for Beyond the Zero. We'll be back with the next episode very soon.